Well, thank you very much. Well, it is an honor to be here tonight, or today rather. I've been doing a number of these rural tours. I think this is the 16th one, Mr. Chairman, that I've done. We've been everywhere from New Hampshire to Alaska and everywhere in between. But this one is particularly special because this is an opportunity for me to be back in my wife's family's home area. I've got the Scriveners who are with us today from Sover and Versailles, and my wife's mom is from this area, and so I feel like I'm kind of home. So I appreciate the family being here. I know that there are at least three friendly faces in this group, which is helpful. And I know that there are an awful lot of local officials here. There are folks who serve in a variety of capacities. But the congressman mentioned his support for the military. And it is not only well known in his district, it is well known around the country. There is no greater supporter for people in uniform than Ike Skelton. And I will tell you that he not only keeps his congressional district safe, his business is to keep all of us safe. And on behalf of my family, I want to thank you. And I'm not sure if this will, if there are any in this group, but in the event there are, I wonder if there are any individuals who served in Vietnam here today. If there are, could you stand up? Let me take this opportunity. You know, folks, you mentioned that you went to Afghanistan. I spent Easter in Iraq and Afghanistan with our National Guard troops when I was governor. We do a great job of welcoming those vets home. We didn't do such a good job of welcoming you guys home. So I want to take this opportunity today to say thank you for everything you guys did for us. And we didn't thank you properly then. And this is a small way of saying thank you today. So thank you. And Madam President, this is quite a facility you've got here. You know, community colleges are one of America's great educational gems, and this is certainly an amazing place. Learned a lot about it in just visiting for a few minutes. Gary, you and the trustees have done a great job of building a facility. It is now an opportunity for over 4,000 folks from this area to get an education. I learned that the average age is about 28, maybe a little bit higher this year, as people come back and get retrained and retooled for a new economy. And that is certainly an important responsibility that community colleges have. So thank you for the opportunity to be here, and thank you for the work that you're doing. Let me just spend just a couple of minutes, if I can, telling you just a few things we're doing at USDA, and then open it up for hopefully 45 minutes or an hour of questions, and hopefully on a broad range of topics and discussions. We have started these rural tours in an effort to try to listen to folks, to learn what's on people's minds, and to give them a sense of what we're trying to do at USDA. And one of the issues that often comes up in these hearings and these forums is, so what about this Recovery and Reinvestment Act? What does it mean to us? What does it mean to my state, to my home area? You know, it's interesting. There are three basic reasons why that recovery bill was important. First, it was important to help people transition from tough times to better times. And one of the things that USDA does, as you well know, is to provide food assistance. There are now 35 million American families who are benefiting from the food assistance programs that we have at USDA, and there was additional money in the Recovery and Reinvestment Act to increase the benefits so those folks could buy a little more at the grocery store. Now you say, well, that's fine, but how does that make a difference to me if I'm not receiving that kind of assistance? Well, if you're a farmer, think about this. If more people are able to buy more at the grocery store, that means more has to be stocked at the grocery store. And if more has to be stocked, then more has to be trucked. And if more has to be trucked, more has to be produced and processed. And if more has to be produced and processed, then that means there's more being purchased. So right through the entire supply chain, food assistance is a direct stimulus to the economy. In fact, within 30 days, 97% of those resources are actually spent and in the economy. And every dollar that we spend in food assistance generates $1.84 of economic activity jobs associated with that assistance. So it's an important stimulus. So first and foremost, it's about bridging from tough times to better times. So tax relief, unemployment extension benefits, and so forth. The second reason we did this was to build the infrastructure, to do the work that Americans wanted and needed done. Whether it's roads or bridges or dams, there's a whole series of infrastructure projects that have been sort of delayed for a long, long time. And we're in the process of trying to make sure that we do right by the infrastructure. And so in Missouri in particular, we have invested a substantial amount of money, over $65 million already, just USDA, in water treatment and wastewater treatment opportunities for small communities. In fact, USDA has invested about $323 million of the Recovery and Reinvestment Act in this state. And if you take all the other agencies of government, it's about $4 billion, $3.4 billion that has been invested so far. So there's more obviously going to be done over the course of the next 12 months, but we are in the process of investing substantial resources in this state. And then finally, it's building the economy of the 21st century. And this is the last point I want to make. And that is that rural America oftentimes is and can be an afterthought, but not today. Today, rural America, I think, for the first time in my lifetime in working with economic development as the mayor of a small town, as a state senator, as a governor, for the first time I see real opportunity on the horizon. Even though there are tough times, even though this is a stressful time, there are real opportunities in four areas. One, the expansion of broadband. Now, I know this state, Governor Nixon just announced a fairly extensive application he's made to USDA and the Commerce Department to try to wire up all of the remote areas of Missouri. That's important because it gives farmers up-to-date information, real-time information, so they can make informed decisions, but it also creates opportunities for the small businesses that are populating these small communities throughout the state to expand their markets, not just to local markets, but to global markets. The second thing is energy. I had an opportunity to be with the good folks from Show Me Energy just a few minutes ago. This is a phenomenal opportunity for this area to convert what heretofore had maybe been something that was not particularly valuable to something extraordinarily valuable. Taking corn stalks, taking waste product from agricultural production and converting it into energy, renewable energy, creates new markets for farmers, creates an opportunity for farmers not only to benefit from production but also processing, creates jobs in the community, helps to build new facilities. And the great thing about these facilities is that they can dot the entire rural countryside of this state and, for that matter, virtually every state in the country. A real opportunity for rural America to have jobs and wealth creation. The third issue is local production being linked to local consumption. The importance of trying to create markets and supply chains that allows a community college, for example, to purchase its food from folks in a 50 or 100-mile radius instead of purchasing it from a food distributor that might be buying it from other states, keeping the wealth here in this area. And finally, while I realize and appreciate that there may be differences of opinion about this in this audience, I want to tell you that for this state, for this area of the country, the issue of climate change and energy is a net winner. We did an evaluation. Bill Holstein is from the USDA is with us today. Bill and a number of other folks from USDA did a calculation and evaluation of the benefit, the net economic benefit from climate change, and their calculation is that over a course of time, we're talking about $10 or $20 billion of net income coming into farm country as a result of offsets. So there's a real opportunity. So you take energy, climate change, broadband, local production and local consumption, and what you have is an opportunity for a renaissance, a renewal of a rural economy. So that's one of the reasons why we're out here, is to talk about the state of things and what we can do to help improve. I know dairy farmers are stressed. I know pork farmers are stressed. I'll probably hear some of that today. If we don't get to your question, if you want to make a comment, we have a website that we are monitoring every day. It's ruraltour.gov, ruraltour.gov, and we encourage folks who don't get a chance to have their question answered today to log on to that website and use that as a way of making sure that we get your opinion and get your question. So with that, all I need, Congressman, is a brave soul to ask the first question, and then it sort of goes from there. So
may I ask it?
Well, absolutely.
I've been asked, and I mentioned this to you earlier today, I've been asked by a number of folks in the agricultural community about our exports and how we can increase our exports and the more markets, the better off we are. And would you, in 25 words, let's tell them what you commented to me.
I'm
counting.
Okay. Well, first of all, it is important for USDA, for farmers and ranchers of this country, to continue to work aggressively to expand exports. We work in concert with the U.S. Trade Representative's Office to try to open up opportunities. There are three pending trade agreements that we hope over time congressional approval is granted.
Get them out there and I'll vote for them.
Right. Panama, Colombia, and South Korea. It's fairly certain, as it is the case with most trade agreements, that agriculture is a net winner. What a lot of folks hear about trade is the deficit. They hear the trade deficit all the time in the news. Well, agriculture doesn't have a trade deficit. We actually have a trade surplus. Somewhere between $12 and $13 billion comes into this country net than what leaves this country in terms of exports and imports. So it's important for us to continue to expand trade. Having said that, we are working very, very hard to try to open up closed markets. Specifically, our media friends have not particularly been helpful to us in terms of the recent H1N1 flu. They characterize it as swine flu that impacts and affects the pork markets. What we don't realize is sometimes when we attach a name to something, that behind that name is a family farm operation that can suffer. We saw our exports decline. 38 countries, Congressman, banned our pork products for a period of time as a result of H1N1. We have now whittled that down to just a handful. We're working on China. Russia recently opened up a number of markets, and we also just South Korea just opened up their market as well. So exports is a very important aspect of this. I went to Africa just 3 weeks ago to talk to 28 African ag ministers to open up trade opportunities. I will go to the to Asia in the fall, and hopefully we'll have further discussions about opening up markets in countries like Korea, Japan, and China. So we are aggressively promoting exports.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Bill Dreyer, Polk County, Missouri. I was down at Nashville 2 or 3 weeks ago, and the way I understand it, all import food that we get in, only 1% of that the USDA checks. Is that right or wrong, or close or whatever? And they also told me, you use the word Safeway, I go to Woods. That's what we got down there. So what if I buy a Woods supermarket, I just can consider it safe. But ever since I left that meeting down there, if I see the word China, I kind of lay it back down. And the catfish, they call it catfish on my local grocery store. But it's not the channel cat I think I'm getting out of Missouri. A lot of that came out of around Vietnam and such what, where there's the water. I wasn't over there, but I was in the military at the same time these two boys were. And their water, we wouldn't call it water here. And so, I was just wondering about, we talk about safe food. Does Mexico not have some of their inspectors on produce out of Washington inspecting the fruit before it goes? Until I was down there, I thought our food was checked, even imported. Did I get some bad information down there or what?
Okay. Well, you opened up a couple of interesting topics for conversation. First of all, food safety. USDA is responsible for meat, poultry, and processed eggs. That's our responsibility, and I can assure you that we have two ways in which we try to make sure that meat, poultry that's being imported in the United States is safe. We have what is called an equivalency test where our food safety people actually go to the foreign countries, go to the facilities that are processing food, and make sure that it is equal to or greater than what we would have in the United States. So, in other words, if it's safe in the United States, we want to make sure that we get the same kind of treatment regardless of where it's coming from. That's the first thing that's done. The second thing that's done is there are also people at the borders that are checking produce, checking products as they come across the border. Our APHIS folks work very closely with the customs people to make sure that we do, in fact, check products that are coming into the United States, particularly from Mexico and from Canada, to make sure that they are safe and secure. So there are two mechanisms. The third thing that we try to do is that we are now in the process of trying to modernize our food safety system within the United States so that we can identify problems as quickly as possible and try to mitigate them. We try to prevent them first And then if there is a problem, we try to mitigate by being able to pinpoint specifically where the problem is and saying that plant's the problem, not all the industry is the problem. We saw that recently with a number of products. You mentioned catfish. That is a very complicated issue, and it is one that we are still in the process of considering. The Congress basically transferred responsibility from the FDA to the USDA to monitor and to inspect catfish. Now, I have an image of a catfish in my head, right? And you have an image in your head, but there are literally, potentially, thousands of varieties of catfish. And the question is how we will define the term catfish will determine what can come into this country and what are the requirements relative to what comes into this country. We've not yet finished that evaluation, but we are very cognizant of the concerns that you've raised about catfish. We want to make sure that when you go to the grocery store, whatever by whatever name it is, that you feel comfortable. The last thing I would say is that the Congress passed, and we are in the process of enforcing, as it relates to meat in particular, country of origin labeling. So you should be able to determine from the grocery store where the product is coming from so that you can make, as an informed consumer, a choice and a decision about where you want your food to come from. Yes.
My name is Steve Borders. I'm the director of the National Farm Worker Job Program in Missouri. I'm also on the board member of the Association of Farm Worker Opportunity Programs in Washington, D.C. We'd like to ask your support and a follow-up to Farm Bill 14204. It talks about Farm Bill 14204 talks about having money available to growers and laborers so that they can have food safety education. It also provides supportive services to farm laborers so that we can have a documented legal farm labor workforce in the United States and maintain that workforce.
I think I know what you're talking about, but we're going to double check and make sure. And if I don't respond to the question, we'll certainly get back to you. But the issue, as it relates to farm labor and making sure that we have well-trained, experienced farm laborers, we are very interested in working with folks. We know that a great deal of our farm labor is seasonal and temporary, and we want to make sure that we have adequate supplies. Sometimes we are challenged to find enough people to do what's necessary. That's why it's important, I think, to create a greater link between local production and local consumption, using rural development resources to create opportunities within this community, for example, to bring vitality back to those kinds of jobs, that you don't necessarily have to rely solely on temporary or seasonal help, that you actually create sort of a permanent employment opportunity. And we are working on this, and we're going to call it Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food. Gets back to this gentleman's point about how safe is the food, how do I know where it's coming from. If we can do a better job of creating a supply chain, storage facilities, distribution facilities, small processing facilities that can survive economically, then you will have a steady supply of labor. You'll have jobs in rural communities, you'll have construction opportunities take place in rural communities, and you also have additional markets that are perhaps more convenient for farmers. So we are involved in creating that kind of system. We'll take a look at this particular provision of the Farm Bill and make sure that we get back to you on it. Yes, sir.
My name is Jerry Presley, Mr. Secretary. Hi, Ike. How you
hey,
doing,
Jerry.
Buddy?
Good to see you.
I represent a lot of people in this state that are associated with the forest industries.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people don't know it, but it's the third largest industry in our state. I have read some of these statements by the administration about ecological restoration of our forests, particularly here in Missouri on the Mark Twain National Forest.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, which an awful lot of our members in southern Missouri utilize the wood that comes off of those forests. We believe strongly in sustainable forestry and using trained loggers and using best management practices and those kinds of things to harvest the wood. It's a little bit like an agricultural crop, but you don't grow it in a year. It takes an awful long time to grow a crop of trees. So we're concerned a little bit about ecological restoration. We do believe that The forest in Missouri, particularly the public forest lands, need to be properly managed and managed with best science, if at all possible. And so we would really like to see the forest properly managed. Ecological restoration here in Missouri, Mr. Secretary, is suggesting that we're going to restore conditions that were here in pre-settlement times. In other words, when the Native Americans were here in Missouri, and we're not sure if that particular emphasis on restoration is probably in the best interest of the economy, particularly in that local area down there, that, and all over the state for that matter. So we would just maybe like to hear your comments about the whole ecological restoration project.
Well, that is a term that I have not specifically used, so I will try to explain to you what we explained just last Friday in Seattle at a speech I gave about forests. Unfortunately, forests are oftentimes not even understood by most people as being part of USDA. And for many, many years, I don't think it got the kind of attention that it needs to get, because it's an important asset of this country for a variety of reasons, one of which most people do not appreciate. And Congressman, you might know this, but I was surprised when I learned that when you take farmland and you take forest land, that those are responsible for 87% of the surface water supply of drinking water in this country. So forests are critical to us having enough water to turn on the tap, whether we live in a small town or we live in an urban center. And so it's important for Americans to understand that. It's also important for Americans to understand the ability of forests to help us adapt and mitigate the impacts of climate change. So what we're looking at is properly maintaining our forests so that we conserve our water and preserve it and make sure that it's high quality, and that we use this as a tool in adapting and mitigating climate change. We recognize that there has to be a balance, and I said this in my speech in Seattle, between the commercial interests that are served by the forests and the need for us to preserve them in a way that helps us maintain water resources, helps us mitigate climate, and also allows us the recreational opportunities that people take advantage of. There needs to be a balance. And we also recognize that each individual national forest is its own little world. You can't have a one-size-fits-all kind of criteria because every place is a little different. And so you have to have an understanding and appreciation for the unique circumstances of the locality. And our forest policy will reflect that. We have invested recently several million dollars in the Mark Twain National Forest for better maintenance. And here's been the problem with our forest maintenance. We have a budget for our Forest Service, and then we have a fire, a major fire. And what we've been doing the last 8 or 9 years or so is taking money from that maintenance budget and using it to fight the fire. Well, there are two problems with that. One is it doesn't give you enough money to fight the fires, and two, it robs your ability to properly maintain the forest that creates the commercial opportunities you're talking about. So what we have proposed and what President Obama has proposed is taking that forest budget and having two pots of money. An adequate pot of money based on a 10-year average cost of fighting fires so that we don't rob Peter to pay for Paul's fire, and a proper budget to maintain forests so that we do systematic and thoughtful thinning, that we do what we need to do to maintain these forests as the asset that they are. So I think what you're going to see is a balanced approach. I honestly don't know about that term that you've defined here. I will tell you that we are interested in that proper balance, and we're very interested in making sure we have adequate resources to fight fires apart from maintaining the forest. Because when we don't maintain the forest, it just builds up the fuel supply, and the fires become more severe, and you continually rob that maintenance budget. It was at one time 13% of the budget. Now it's 50% of the budget. Well, you can't sustain forests if you're using all the money to fight the fires. So I think we're going to take a more enlightened approach on firefighting and budgeting, and I think we're going to strike a better balance between the need for conserving water and climate change issues in recreation and the commercial interests.
Mr. Secretary, let me interrupt. The fourth district, you're probably familiar with it nonetheless, but we go all the way from heavy row crop up from where I'm from, near the Missouri River, all the way down to and include a lot of forest land down there, which we're probably one of the most diverse congressional districts in the country. Well, we don't have cotton, we don't have rice, we have everything else. But I just thought I'd throw that out. A lot of folks don't realize we have forest land in our district. Thank you for your comment.
Sir, in the back. Can you wait for just the microphone? That way everybody can hear.
Yeah, my name is Johnny Garl, and I live over at Marshall in Saline County.
Johnny, could you put the mic up? Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I live at Marshall. I'm in Saline County, and I'm looking around for my neighbors, and I don't see any Saline County farmers here, and I would like to see a show of hands of actual farmers in the crowd. Very good. Thank you.
Sir.
My name is Matt Boatwright. I'm right here in Sedalia, Missouri. I'm a farmer on the east side of Sedalia and also in the ag lending business. But my question is about cap and trade. Mm-hmm. I think by any count, there is going to be a price tag associated with that. Congressman Dingell said about $175 a person for the average consumer in the course of a year. But for agriculture, it's a energy-intensive business. Mm-hmm. And I have specific concerns as it relates to segments in agriculture. I know there's been recent attempts to try to add amendment to try to help the mitigation, if you will, of expense, I believe, of the increased fuel costs. I think your letter came out this week, said about $2 a gallon increase in the price of gasoline estimated. You can read a lot of different things. My question is this. It appears that there are certain segments in agriculture that really aren't going to have a way to participate in any offsets and yet are going to have all the tax associated with the incredible increase in the price of energy, whether it's the electricity or gasoline. In this case, we have a lot of integrators in our community, whether poultry or swine facilities. And quite frankly, they're predominantly smaller operations. They're integrators. They may not have a lot of row crop. I know they're going to get charged for all the energy they use for the heating and cooling and all those kind of things for the great production they produce. But what plans do you have to have an offset or way for them to participate, or are they just going to bear the brunt?
Well, I appreciate you asking that question. That's a very important question. Let me first of all say one thing about the bill that passed through the House that a lot of folks may not appreciate or realize. You mentioned energy costs, and obviously people are concerned about that and fertilizer. The way the bill was structured, the fertilizer industry in particular will receive some assistance and benefit in the early going of this process. So in the first 7-10 years of this effort, there should not be any increase in fertilizer cost as a result of this bill because of the benefits that the industry will get from the bill. In other words, they should be roughly equivalent to whatever they think their increased cost could be. On the energy side, I don't think there's any doubt that there will be an increase. The question is whether or not there will be an offsetting income opportunity that will be equal to or greater than or less than the energy costs. We have done an evaluation at USDA, and we did it very conservatively. We made two assumptions, which I think are absolutely false assumptions in our report. First, the assumption was that farmers would not take any steps to adapt. Well, I think farmers are some of the most adaptive people in the country. They're innovators, they're thoughtful, they look at the bottom line, and they look for ways to increase opportunities in the bottom line. So that's an assumption I think is not accurate. The second is that there would be no new technology developed. Well, these folks here at Show Me Energy are in the process of developing new technology, which they believe, and I believe, has great potential. So those are the two assumptions, but we made those assumptions because we wanted the most conservative estimate possible of the impact on agriculture. Then we looked at the offset side, and we concluded over the long term, in the short term it's about a break-even proposition, on the long term, 10, 20 years down the road, you're looking at 10 and maybe as much as $20 billion of income opportunity for farmers. Now, you're correct. Every farm situation is different. Every region of the country is different. I think livestock producers will find more opportunity than they think. because there will be opportunities for offsets for capturing methane, for feed additives that will reduce methane, which we're seeing in a dairy farm in New Hampshire, for example. They've been able to reduce methane by a third in their dairy cows. That's the kind of thing that will generate opportunity. We see a tremendous market for renewable energy. I was in a facility in Southern Virginia where I saw dry manure being used as the fuel source for producing ethanol. So there's a lot of innovation that's going to take place. But in the event that you're an operation that can't take advantage of any of that, then what we'll see is a utilization of the other programs at USDA, the other conservation programs at USDA, to make sure that those folks who aren't being able to participate will be able to aggressively participate in those conservation programs. So you have an opportunity here to use the resources of USDA to mitigate the impact. Now I know this is a controversial issue, and I know there's a lot of angst about this. I genuinely believe the great advantage the United States has is its capacity to innovate. And I think we're going to see opportunities here that we can't even imagine today, 5 years from now and 10 years from now. As it relates to the really small producer, I go back to my comments earlier about the necessity of creating alternative markets where maybe the transportation expense, the marketing expense is not as great as it is today. And I think if we could create alternative markets where we link local producers with local consumers, develop a supply chain where farmers may be, as is the case with Show Me Energy, a cooperative with a processing facility or a storage facility, then you have opportunities to benefit not only from the production of agricultural products, but also the processing and the selling of them locally. So, you know, I think we're developing a new paradigm here for rural America, which I think is long overdue. And I think I'm hopeful and optimistic that it will put more money in the pockets of farmers. Now you say, well, geez, aren't we seeing consolidation of farms, and aren't we seeing fewer farmers? Here's the interesting thing about the survey of ag survey that was just conducted. In the category of sales less than $10,000, very small operations, we saw 108,000 new operations in the last 5 years. 108,000 new operations around the country. In the category of production agriculture, the guys who are got $500,000 in sales or greater, the folks who represent roughly 5% of the farmers but produce 75% of what we eat, amazing productivity, amazing story, we saw 41,000 more of those operations. The challenge is the folks in the middle, between $10,000 in sales and $500,000 in sales. And what I'm trying to figure out is how USDA creates multiple income opportunities for those mid-sized operations. And I think energy, and I think offsets create opportunity in that category. I think the local production, local consumption helps the small folks and the mid-sized folks. And I think pushing exports, pushing biotechnology helps particularly production agriculture be able to export more. So we have a broad range of strategies here to try to help virtually every category of farming. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Tom Orich from rural Pettis County, just south of Sedalia. Appreciate you and Representative Skelton being here today. I am a dairy farmer, and as you indicated earlier in your remarks, it's pretty tough being a dairy farmer. I do appreciate the effort that you've made with the DEEP program and reauthorizing it and reallocating those amounts according to World Trade. I appreciate that very much, and also your leadership in the Farm Bill to raise the price supports. My concern is, and I've also echoed them with my pork producer friends, the disparity in the supermarket between the retail price and the farm price. My income's dropped, my pay price has dropped over 50%, but yet in the grocery store, it hasn't come down probably less than 25%. I was wondering if you had any thoughts or comments about how to address that.
Sure. First of all, if I can, just a brief explanation of DEEP so people understand what that is. It gets back to the congressman's question about exports. You know, when dairy farmers are stressed, one avenue of opportunity is to try to export some of that surplus product in parts outside the United States. The problem is the global economy suffers, and so people buy less milk, buy less cheese, buy less dairy product. So what we're trying to do is to try to make our exporters competitive with some of our trading friends who because their governments highly subsidize them or because they've got a different regime or a different circumstance, they're able to undercut our price on the world market. So the DEEP program basically provides federal resources to those exporters so they can lower their price so it's competitive and so we can move product out of the United States. We are cognizant of the concerns that you expressed about the disparity between what the farmer gets and what the consumer has to pay. The Department of Justice, we've had a conversation with the Department of Justice, and we are going to, in the first part of next year, have a series of hearings that are looking at sort of the antitrust monopoly pricing issues that are sort of out there that people talk about, but you never really know whether or not, you know, what the deal is, and you don't know what the facts are, and you don't give people an opportunity to have a conversation about this. Well, we're going to create that conversation. We're going to have these set of hearings and an effort to try to figure out precisely what's going on so that we can create a more balanced, more level playing field for farmers of all size. All right? That's one thing. And the Justice Department is very serious about this. They have an individual who is specifically focused on these particular set of issues. Who's working on this, and we raised the need for a review of it. The other thing we're attempting to do is to create greater transparency in terms of pricing, and we will be announcing some rules relative to our GPSA program that may level the playing field a bit more than what we've seen in the past. And those are going to be forthcoming over the course of the next couple of months. The last thing I would say is that the dairy industry in particular has had a boom and bust cycle. Wide disparity between prices that you received 18, 20 months ago, things look great. Now things are dire. We think that there needs to be a discussion about how we might be able to create greater stability in that price band. And we're taking a look at internally with some external assistance and advice, what could we do? What should we do? What could we convince Congress to do to create greater stability in a price band so you don't have this boom and bust cycle and you don't have people getting in the business and then people getting out of the business?
I appreciate that.
Well, I now can say I've talked to 100% of the dairy farmers in your county. It's the unfortunate question. Yes, sir.
Thank you for taking my question. This is related to the broadband initiative. Mm-hmm. I wanted to find out where the state ranks in comparison to other states in this regard.
Let me make sure I understand your question. Are you asking where Missouri ranks relative to the other 49 states in terms of broadband access, or are you asking where Missouri's application ranks in the 4,000 applications that we just got?
Let's answer both of them. Okay.
Well, I don't know the answer to either one. The reason I don't know the answer to the 4,000 is we are in the process of just collecting these applications and processing them, just to give the group a sense of what we're talking about here. The Recovery and Reinvestment Act gave the USDA $2.5 billion to use to, in the form of grants and or loans to communities, to businesses, to states and whatever, to create access to broadband in remote and rural areas. In fact, I think the congressman instructed us that 75% of our resource has to be spent in those areas. Now, we're still refining the definition of rural and remote, but we are going to distribute these resources in three parcels. The first parcel will be distributed by virtue of these applications that we received, that the deadline's now shut off. We will be probably making awards sometime in October, November of this year. The second group will be probably in the late fall, early winter 2010. Excuse me, I'm sorry, the early winter or late winter of 2010. And then the final distribution will be in the spring or summer of 2010. Our $2.5 billion will actually leverage, because of the way we guarantee loans and so forth, about $9 billion of activity. The Commerce Department has another $4 billion. We are dividing these applications because we had a common application to try to make it easier on people by zip codes. We're having a little technology problem that we're working through, but eventually they're going to be divided. Commerce gets their pile, we get our pile, and then we begin the ranking process. I know in talking to Governor Nixon that there are a number of counties in this state that really need help and assistance. And I know that he knows that the state to the north of him, my home state, has a fairly aggressive effort that we started 20 years ago to provide access to fiber optic activity. I honestly don't know where Missouri ranks relative to the other 50 states. You know, I know that this is a priority issue for the governor. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Say, first of all, beautiful day today the Lord has given us, each one of us. I'm very proud to be American. I hope each one of you are. I'm proud to have a Congressman Ike Skelton on our side. You know, when I look at the flag, I say, hey, that's, I pledge allegiance to the republic for which it stands. And so I'm proud that we have a system where each state represents, votes for their representative. It goes to Washington, D.C., and, of course, also in the state. And Ike Skelton is a very great representative, and we thank you for inviting me. And I also want to mention Mr. Jerry Litton. How many know Jerry Litton? Jerry Litton is one of those kind of guys, only 2 years in Congress, he did more to bring agriculture to the forum. He brought, took a steer and put it outside of congressional building. And that's a steer to make a steak out of, you know. Jerry Litton was really great. It's just a shame that he was put down. You know, he died when he had an upset landslide victory over a very powerful senator. But anyway, Jerry believed very strongly that we should pay natural resources of any country. They should be paid very well, not the paper people. And I just have to say that our downturn is from paper traders. Now, I'll tell you, my wife and I have been farming for 51 years, high production agriculture. I got very passionate about renewable energy in 79. That's ethanol and biodiesel. And so I see a tendency now for some people to put down ethanol and biodiesel now. And I can't understand that, because we are importing so much petroleum all the time. And who's building refineries? The farmers, the producers out there are taking the corn, cellulose, soybeans, and making refineries so we have a liquid fuel up in our tanks. Yeah, someday down the road, we'll put a hydrogen peel in, but that's not here now. And we need all forms of energy. So I'm all for all forms. But I am concerned that when the cap and trade bill was passed in the House, that one of the reasons was that, well, the EPA is going to control it unless we do something. Now, I thought that Congress controlled all our government agencies. To me, the EPA, maybe, and I apologize to anybody, I don't need to step on toes, but maybe they're on a mind of their own. Point being, a congressional hearing not long ago, and check this out, write this down if you'd like, EPA, ethanol, YouTube. This person had been with the EPA from 1980 up to 1980. And a question was asked by one of the representatives, well, what about how come the renewable energy had to pay tax for the Brazils cutting down the timber? And her response was, check this out on detail. Her response was, oh, well, you know, this renewable energy, it takes 67 bushels of corn per to produce 1 gallon of ethanol. Now, let's get it straight. You get 2.8 gallons of ethanol out of every bushel of corn, plus 17 pounds of high-quality feed for the feed industry. So we produce 150 bushel average, 150 bushel corn to the acre. And we get 2.8 gallons per bushel. So how could it take 67 acres or 64 acres to produce 1 gallon of ethanol? And then she went ahead and say, it takes 400 acres of soybeans to produce 1 gallon of biodiesel. But that's totally wrong. And so I lose my ability to respect the EPA, and if we don't let those people run the country, I'm concerned about it.
Okay.
On the biodiesel side, excuse me a second, Mr. Secretary. On a biodiesel side, for every bushel of soybeans, we get 42 pounds of high protein, 48% protein, to feed to the dairy, to the poultry industry. We get 3 pounds of soybean hulls, and we get about a gallon of 1.4 gallons of biodiesel or oil that we turn into biodiesel with one bushel. Now, how can it take 400 acres times 50 bushels to the acre to produce 1 gallon of biodiesel? Thank you for your time.
Well, I'm sure the congressman would agree it won't be the first time that somebody in Washington's been wrong. Right, Congressman? We have a tendency to be wrong from time to time. It's one of the reasons why we're doing this rural tour, is to make sure that we respond to questions and concerns. I'd respond in a couple of ways. First of all, the congressman knew, and Colin Peterson, as the chair of the Ag Committee, knew that it was important and relevant in this discussion of cap and trade to make sure that the USDA was involved in a meaningful way in terms of establishing offset programs, running the offset program, monitoring it, regulating it, and so forth. And because of the amendment that Colin Peterson proposed and a majority of folks voted for, USDA does have an integral role in this process, and we should, because we've got people who've been working on this issue for, Bill, how long have you been working on this? 20 years? 17 years? We've got other folks in the department who've been working on it for 20 years who know all of the ins and outs of this, and so that's number one. I want to reassure you about that. The reason why people are saying that the EPA could potentially be in charge of regulating if something is not done is because of a Supreme Court case. And in the Supreme Court case, it essentially created the capacity of the EPA to regulate tailpipe emissions, and in order to do that consistent with the Clean Air Act that Congress passed, they would essentially be in a position to regulate a good deal of activity in rural communities and across the country. And I think that that is a concern that a lot of folks legitimately have, and I think they would prefer to see a different approach, and you obviously would as well. So first of all, I want to reassure you USDA is involved in this. USDA is going to work with federal agencies to make sure that agriculture is adequately protected, adequately represented, that the facts are accurate. It also, I think it's important to point out that the bill that was passed by the House contains a provision that this issue of Brazil and so forth doesn't get into effect unless USDA signs off on it, and unless there's at least a 5-year period, and unless we get more data and more information. The EPA just recently peer-reviewed their proposal in connection with this particular issue, and some of the peer reviewers basically said, look, the science is not accurate yet. We don't know enough to really be formulating serious policy based on this. So they suggested, at least some of them, a wait-and-see attitude. And Congress obviously agreed with that, and I suspect as the Senate discusses this issue that you'll probably see a confirmation of that. I don't know, yeah. Congressman, if you want to add something to that.
The only thing I want to add, Martin, thanks for your nice comments, by the way. I'm a minority in Congress. There are no more than 60 to 80 rural members out of 435 in the House of Representatives. And we pretty much stick together on that. And when it comes to EPA, you say, well, Congress can control it. Well, we don't have the majority to control it. That's why I felt it's important for the USDA to look at and control any rural emissions. They understand agriculture. And let me tell you, you want to have the EPA controlling tractors, combines, trucks, livestock emissions. I'll repeat it, livestock emissions. That's silly. Or do you want the USDA to be in charge of it? And that's it. I am a minority in Congress that faces that every once in a while on various votes.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Mike Geske, a farmer from Missouri and president of Missouri Corn Growers Association. He kind of stole my thunder a little bit, but I'll expand on that just a little bit. The administration and you and certainly Representative Skelton have been strong supporters of renewable energy, and we really appreciate that. But we as an organization have a real concern about EPA, particularly the indirect land use change issue. You know, they just, the results they have come out with have not been able to be replicated by anybody else. And they recently did a peer review, and the peer reviewers were very obviously people that had previously demonstrated that they were not unbiased in regard to corn ethanol. It would be very helpful if the USDA was one of those peer reviewers. And it's not just this issue, it's a multiple issue thing. Also, they announced the peer reviewers of an atrazine review. And once again, they put people on there that really are very biased, has demonstrated their bias previously. The administration, and particularly USDA, really needs to get more involved with EPA and rein them in, because they appear to be sort of a government entity out of control. Do you see some possibilities that the administration can get more involved and try to help us?
You know, I think that the reason why the bill that the congressman alluded to, we just talked about, contained a provision that said that things can't take place on indirect land use unless USDA signs off on it, is a result of not only congressional input but also USDA input. And I think I have been conversing with Lisa Jackson, the administrator of EPA, on multiple occasions about a variety of issues, including my advocacy for raising the blend rate. And my hope is that as we look at the 10% going up to 12, 13, 15% on the ethanol blend, that we get a favorable determination from EPA on that. I don't control that decision, but I can certainly advocate for it, which I have done and which I'll continue to do. And I know the president is very strongly supportive of it. And I know that those in the White House have conveyed that. So I think that that is happening. And I understand your concern, but I will just tell you this. When I was hired for this job, the president said two things to me. At least I think it's the first thing, two things he said to me, because I was a little shocked he actually offered the job to me. He wanted us to obviously, especially our children, because we're faced with some serious problems in terms of hunger and obesity with our kids, he wanted to make sure that they were well-fed. And he also wanted to make sure that the biofuels industry was supported, which is why he put together an executive order directing me to get the biofuel rules out within 30 days of the Farm Bill, which we did. And we're in the process of trying to figure out how to get the resources out to the countryside to help farmers produce these alternative feedstocks and help biorefineries retrofit and develop. And by the way, I did email about your situation in the truck on the way over here. We'll see if we get a response before I leave. And so the executive order is asking us to develop a game plan for improving market opportunities for biofuels. So our request of the corn growers is help us. I met with the renewable energy folks yesterday in Iowa, encouraging you to help us figure out precisely what we do need to do in addition to what's already being done to make that market grow. What do we have to do relative to the cars, to the distribution system, to the pumping mechanisms? What kind of incentives do we have to provide? Do we really push E85, or would we be better off pushing E10, E15, E20, and blend pumps that you could calibrate? We need that information from you, so we in turn can be better advocates for you inside the administration. But I do want to assure you that those conversations do take place on an almost daily basis between staff and between principals and with the president. Let's see. Anybody in the back?
How about Dwayne there?
Well, you know Dwayne. I don't know Dwayne. Who's Dwayne? Dwayne, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, for coming to Missouri. We appreciate it. As you mentioned, the dairy and hog farmers are struggling. And right now, to make matters worse, credit is tightening. You announced last week that USDA is retooling its loan assistance program. What can be done to provide greater certainty for lenders to stick with producers until the markets turn around?
We have two things. Number one, as it relates to our direct operating loans, the ones that actually come directly from USDA, we've instructed our Farm Service folks to work with struggling producers. If it can be restructured in terms of interest rate reductions, deferral of payments, reduction of principal, whatever makes some economic sense and whatever makes sense we want to do, and we've instructed our folks to be aggressive in looking at how to keep folks on the farm. We have a guaranteed loan program, and while we don't have as much control over that because it's a commercial lender decision, we are basically trying to work with our commercial lenders, taking a look at our guarantee efforts to determine whether or not we can up or increase the guarantees so the risk to the commercial banker is reduced so that they in turn do the same thing we're doing, which is look at interest rates, deferral of payments, and reduction of principal. After this meeting today, specifically, I'm going to have a meeting with commercial bankers who are responsible for lending a good deal of money to ethanol production facilities and biofuel facilities. And our message is, look, this is a matter of national security. It's a matter of economic opportunity in rural communities. We at USDA are willing to increase our guarantee to 90%, so you have very little skin in the game. You got to help these folks maintain the infrastructure of the biofuel industry, because it's very hard to convince investors for second and third generation biofuels to be excited about that future if the first generation is in foreclosure. That message is going to be strongly conveyed to bankers. We're going to continue to encourage them and ask them, are there ways in which we can provide help to reduce that risk to you? So those conversations are actually going to take place today. Yes, sir.
First, thanks to you for being here in Missouri. We sure do appreciate it. I'm Kenny Lenz, a dairy producer from Cooper County, just 40 miles to the north and east of here. We have a family corporation for a farm. My brother and myself are two sons, and we have two employees. General farming operation. One thing I would like to say is that none of our wives work off the farm. So if we don't make a profit, we don't eat. And so just lately, we've cut down to two meals a day. So things are pretty tight on dairy farm. But I have maybe 2 points of concern. One, the other gentleman asked about the disparity between what we get and what the grocery stores get. From my own point of view, knowing the Justice Department, I'm not so sure that we as dairy farmers want the Justice Department mingling in the pricing of milk. All I can see happening is that the retailers will come back to the processors and say, well, we can't mark milk up this much, well, you sell your milk to us cheaper. They'll come back to us and say, we can't get your milk sold at a good price because the retailers can't mark it up, and we'll get less for our milk. That may or may not happen, but it is a concern of mine. And secondly, what's on cap and trade? Matt Boatwright asked a cap and trade question. As a dairy producer milking like 150 cows, you mentioned the digesters and so forth. With our size dairy, it's just not going to be practical. And you mentioned some options that may be out there. Maybe you could reiterate them a little bit. But right now, my son and my nephew are managing the farm. Dairy farmers in Missouri are decreasing in size and in numbers just dramatically in the last few years. And I can see my son and my nephew looking at our dairy operation and saying, you know, the last couple of years, this has not been profitable. We're just going to sell out and do our beef cows and our cropping rotation. And we do have one of the better herds in the state of Missouri, and I hate to see that happen. But I'm afraid my son and my nephew will make that business decision, and once you're out, you ain't coming back. Thank you.
Well, first of all, the Department of Justice isn't necessarily going to get in the business of pricing milk. They're just simply going to be determining whether or not there's an unfairness in the system, and whether or not someone has market power or market share or is controlling the market in a way that is disadvantaging people who are in the business. All right, so I don't think they're going to say that's our job. I think to a certain extent USDA is taking a look at that price band and determining whether or not there are any other ways that we can provide greater stability so that you get a fair return for your product, and at the same time you're not taking advantage of and the consumer's not taking advantage of. So I want to make sure that that's clear. As it relates to opportunities, there are a couple that are in the process of being worked on. Number one, and I appreciate that maybe today the concept of digesters may not be feasible for an operation your size, but that assumes that the technology basically stops. That is not going to happen. people are going to try to figure out how to make that technology more efficient, more available, smaller scale. They're going to try to figure out ways in which they can get the business opportunity that your operation could present them, number one. Number two, there are people who are currently experimenting with the way in which dairy cows are fed, what they are fed, in order to reduce the amount of methane. Stonyfield Farms, which is a yogurt manufacturer in New Hampshire, believes that they found a way of reducing methane by a third. As you look at those kinds of opportunities, that's the type of thing that could potentially qualify for an offset. Third, the Southern Missouri or Southern Virginia operation that basically takes dried manure and purchases it from a local dairy farmer that's not very much larger than your operation, and using that to create ethanol and biochar, another potential opportunity. I guess the message I would say to your son and is it your son and grandson? Nephew. To your son and nephew is, don't count the capacity of Americans to be world innovators. I mean, we seem to, sometimes we lose confidence in what is the one of the great things about being an American, is that because of the way our country's structured, we have always been the innovators. Now, we got a lot of competition. We got a lot of smart people globally that are competing with us, but we're up to that competition. We can beat these folks. We can match them, and we can figure out ways that, 5 years ago, you started this operation, 5 years ago, did you tell me? Okay, 7 years ago, what you're doing today, I mean, the idea of pelletizing and creating an energy source for a power plant, come on, what are you, crazy? That's not going to happen. Well, yeah, it is happening. It's creating 18 jobs. It's creating a market for farmers. It's creating a value for something that was perhaps not as valuable as it is today. That's just the beginning. We're just at the cusp of all of this. So I have great confidence in all the people who raise their hand here today that say they're farmers. I mean, I think the sky's the limit for us. Now, is it hard? Is it stressful? You bet. And, the fact that your wives aren't working off the farm, highly unusual. Here's a couple of very concerning statistics. 55% of American farmers do not identify farming as their principal occupation. 900,000 operators in this country, of the 2.2 million farmers and ranchers, themselves, not their spouses, themselves have to work at least 200 days off the farm. Now, last time I checked, that's pretty doggone close to a full-time job. So it is hard to say to the next generation, what a great life. You get to work not one job, but two. But here is the pushback on that. This place we call rural America is, in my view, the heart and soul of this country. In my view, this is the place where we celebrate family and community every day. When something happened on your farm and you had trouble, you had cancer or the barn burned down, your neighbors would be there to help you. Your neighbors would be there to put the crop in, to milk the cows, to help build the barn back. Why is that? Because this concept of community is in the bone marrow of people who live in rural communities. And so it's necessary for us to figure out a way in which the economics of rural America allow that value system to maintain and be maintained. And that's why when you link local producers with local consumption, when you look at the possibilities of opening up markets, greater export opportunities, energy opportunities, I see a chance that we haven't had for a long time to reverse the trend that you've just alluded to. So I'm not going to stop believing in this process. And I don't want you either, and I sure as heck don't want your son and nephew to stop believing. I'm told I've got time for... One more question, sir. And you work for me? If I answer them short, can I get two? Okay, two questions. You, sir, and then I'll finish with you, ma'am.
My name is Randy Railsback, and I'm one of those people you were just talking about. I live on a Century Farm outside a small community of 2,000 people, but I'm also the executive director of the Green Hills Regional Planning Commission. And so I wanted to visit. I've got three of the other directors here with me today and talk about some of the dollars you mentioned earlier that are going to communities for infrastructure development and how that process has worked. And I think Missouri has been recognized as a leader in getting those dollars delivered as fast as possible and maybe even faster than many other states. I think we have a great process that could be improved as well, and I think we have a unique opportunity here. You have a new state director here for Missouri who's only been with the agency for, I think, 42 years, started when she was 12.
Well, you appreciated that comment, didn't
you? Yeah. As well as staff at the state level, as well as regional planning commissions and other partners that could help streamline the process and getting those dollars out there and how we merge those processes with other federal agencies like HUD, CDBG, especially, and unfortunately EPA, because that process has gotten slower and slower rather than faster and faster. So I'd encourage you to take a study group or something and tap into this expertise and see what we can do to figure that out.
Well, let me briefly respond to that. I have encouraged the administration to create a process by which we can begin the process of better integration. You can see the first indication of that in the way in which we're reporting on the recovery and reinvestment resources. We have a website in which we're using geospatial technology to let you know precisely where all the projects in Commerce, USDA, HUD, Justice, and we hope to be able to add other agencies so you have a sense of where the resources are currently going. That has led the Vice President to direct us to continue the discussions about how we might be able to better integrate our decision-making process so that we have critical mass. But the challenge for us is to understand that development has to be looked at regionally and not community by community, not specific community by community. We need to look at things regionally. That's number one. Number two, the process absolutely has to be streamlined. And I will tell you, a little disturbing by the fact that in some of these programs, if I apply for a $5,000 program or I apply for a $5 million program, I got to fill out the same doggone paperwork. Well, that doesn't make much sense to me. We ought to streamline the $5,000 deal, and so that gets done, and we ought to spend a little time on the $5 million deal because that's obviously a bigger deal, but we ought to be able to streamline that process. And we are absolutely have instructed our rural development folks in Washington to begin that process. So I couldn't agree more. And, you know, I the fact that he lied about your 42 years, I think that's unfortunate. I know you've only been working for 42 months. How's that? Ma'am, you're the last question.
Secretary Vilsack, thank you so much for coming to Outstate Missouri, particularly Pettis County. We really appreciate your time. I'm local here. I belong to WIFE, a group of women involved in farm economics. We tried to see you in February when you first took your job, and you were pretty busy, so we didn't get to see you. But all these things, and coming from a woman's standpoint of view, I really think America needs to keep our farm families, even if they have to have people working off the farm. I feel like America is stronger and better. I'm a golden oldie, so World War II, I think the ag group are what really kept America going. And all these people, WIFE has considered their problems, the gentleman on the catfish. I really believe COOL has been a wonderful thing for us, knowing what we're going to have. WIFE has worked very hard for that. I'd like for you to see that the packers and different ones do not jeopardize what was put in it. I spoke with the gentleman that helped write the bill, and where they had mixed meats, it was just to clean up the processing plant at the end of the day, not to start off the day that way. I think that will help American farmers a great deal, because we do have regulations that we have to go by that others don't. I've never been in dairy, but a dear friend of mine in Kansas, they just closed their dairy this year. I think one of the things, if you get the Justice Department in, what we've studied on that, the foreign countries get to trade powdered milk to bring it in. I guess there's some way they can do that to undercut our dairy farmers. And the gentleman from Pettis County worried about cap and trade. You know, I am too. I think agriculture has really worked on conservation. And, you know, we have done no-till
and what have you. I think maybe there's something coming up where maybe you will, and you spoke to that to a degree, give agriculture some cut in it. But I thank you very much and try to keep EPA out of agriculture. Thank you.
A couple of things about COOL. You alluded to this issue, and maybe some people may not know this, but these packers, it's a processing facility. It's kind of an interesting comment. What will happen is that they'll purchase something from American beef, and they'll put it through the process, and or Canadian beef, say. They'll put it through the process. And then at the end of the day, they'll want to finish a lot, but they don't have enough meat from that supply, so they'll take another source, might come from a different country, and put it in the system and finish it out. And so then you have to label that a product of Canada and United States or whatever. But what griped me was that they said that they needed to continue that labeling for 60 days afterwards. And I brought the folks in, I went, 60 days? I mean, come on. I mean, maybe there's a little remnant of it, you know, a couple days later, but 60 days, that you guys are just trying to get around the rule. So we've basically asked them, and we've told them in a letter that I wrote, to substantially reduce that time period and to actually live up to not just the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law. Now, we do get in trouble with our trading partners on this. You know, the folks in Canada are concerned about it. The folks in Mexico are concerned about it. And we are just simply saying, look, this is about our consumers wanting to know where their food comes from. That's all it is. You know, so that's it. But they believe it somehow. It's trade distorting, and we're going to have a fuss and fight about that, unfortunately. But we think it's about consumer education, and you've basically reinforced that with your comments today. Well, let me, Congressman, I'm going to give you the last word because this is your district, but I just want to say one thing about this man. He has taught me something today, a very valuable lesson. So we're in this little holding room, just the Congressman, myself, President of College. And I see this plate with tin foil around it. And I think to myself, this is what I thought to myself, Madam President. I thought, oh, isn't that nice? They make cookies for us. Us. The two of us. She gets real excited. She comes over to the Congressman. She says, here, you're expecting this. He goes, he doesn't even look at it. He knows exactly what it is. It's a gooseberry pie. And so he looks at me, and he says, so now I'm sort of crestfallen because I was really kind of counting on a couple of cookies. And he says, well, you know, my late wife, she only had one fault, and that is that she really couldn't make a good gooseberry pie, and I have to kind of let people know that. And so every time I come to an event like this, I get a gooseberry pie. Very smart, Congressman. Now, I can't say that because my wife's a good pie maker, but I'm going to figure out something else because that was a pretty good deal. And that's why he's been in Congress for as long as he's been, because he's a smart cookie. Congressman, it's all yours.
And with good friends, I will share a piece.
That's because you've got four in the freezer.
Thank you very much. You know, we're very, very fortunate to have a Secretary of Agriculture who's not only a neighbor, but understands agriculture, and we're blessed. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, this is a very diverse congressional district, going all the way down from the northern part of the district, Ray County, all the way down through Webster County to not that many miles from Arkansas. It's a great, greatly diverse agriculture district, but we know agriculture, rural America is where it's at. And my staff, the Army Services staff, do a review about a year ago on where, it was just the Army, where the young men and young women come from in the Army. 49% come from small town and rural America. 27% of them come from the inner cities, and the rest come from the suburbs and elsewhere. And there's a great strain of patriotism here in small town rural America. I just thought I would share that with you.
immensely proud of them. Thank you for coming. Thank you all. God bless. Thank you.
Thank you.